coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio, located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation. It's your host, Doug Hagman.
And welcome to Hagman. It is the Hagman Report. I want to welcome everyone. I want to say thank you to everyone who listens, who tunes in. I want to thank you for inviting me, my guests, into your living room, into your office, into your private space, into your vehicle. I want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you. And thank you for your support as well. Without your support, I'm going to tell you, we would not be able to do what we do. And I think we do a pretty good job of what we do. I know Eric the Tech is the best out there. I'm going to tell you right now. And you know, he's not even paying me to say this, but I've got to say that in terms of technology, Eric the Tech is the best. So thank you, Eric. And without him, you wouldn't be hearing my voice. By the way, Keith Hansen, of course, the third hour, of the Hagman Report. Very good program. Tune in. The Keith Hansen Show. It's also available on our Spreaker. Well, in fact, I'll make it easy for everyone. Go to HagmanReportLive.com, HagmanReportLive.com. There you'll find all of our programs. There it is. All of our programs. All of our shows. Popular uploads. Our main show, the Hagman Report, and Keith's show as well. And I also want to say thank you to my good friend Peter Barry Chowka. Thank you for all you do and have done and continue to do. Thanks, Keith. Thank you, Kevin, by the way, for all you do, your hard work. Matt and others, Rhonda, my goodness. They all work together or work independently, but together they bring you what is known as the Hagman Report. And again, I'm just so thankful for the people that we have in our lives, I have in my life, and each one of you, definitely each one of you. The headlines. Yeah, and you know why? People might say, well, you've bidden adieu, your final farewell. No, I was just looking at a couple of things, and I was thinking, you know, we take a lot of things for granted, don't we? Hey, this could be my last show. This could be, you know, who knows, right? The headlines are certainly dire, but I blame that a lot on the hyper sensitivity of the media or the weaponization of the media. It's not to say things aren't going on out there because they are. It's not to say the coronavirus isn't a thing because it is. It's not to say, it's just to say, look, God's got this. And I hope everyone knows God's got this. We are not to walk in fear. And often I don't say that enough. Again, my thanks to everyone. If you logged on to Drudge, hey, 70% will be infected by coronavirus. And there's so many other things as well taking place. Look, we are 230 some odd days, I believe it is, away from a general election, a presidential election where we elect the president of the United States. And, everyone says, oh, it's a lock. It's a lock. Donald Trump's got this. Well, I'm going to tell you this. I don't believe anything today is a lock. I don't believe anything is, I do believe that things are open, that anything can happen. I don't know what's going to happen, but I can tell you, I'm going to tell you sure one thing, and I'm going to bring my guest on here. I don't want to cut into his time, but I will say this. Information that I have been receiving from multiple sources, and Madge, you can stick this in your pipe and smoke it. You can put it where the sun don't shine, but multiple sources have been telling me two things. Well, actually, you know what? It's open source. Project Veritas. Look, if Bernie Sanders does not get the nomination, the left, the Antifa, the Democratic, Socialist, Communist, Activists, whatever, they intend to burn the place down, to riot. And regardless, if President Trump is reelected in November, expect anarchy, expect chaos. Just like the coronavirus, folks, I just want to say this. You know, it's a thing. Yes, it is real. And I personally, this is my personal belief, based on a lot of research, but I believe it's structured as a bioweapon. That was the intent. Now, I don't know whether it was released intentionally. I don't know about that. There's some say there was a car accident, a convoy accident, others incompetence, whatever. But what I'm looking at is the exploitation, the deliberate exploitation, where the media, I believe, is conducting a social experiment and event. Just understand my words. I'm selecting them carefully. It's an experiment, yet it's an event that they're exploiting. Why? To control you and I. We have gone so far right now away from the Constitution, our founding document, the contract between our government and the people of the United States. We interchange the word democracy with republic, thinking it's the same. Many of us do, and it's not. Oftentimes, you might catch me say democracy when I mean republic. And I'm learning to watch my, how would I say? But people erroneously refer to the United States as a democracy. We're not a democracy. We are a constitutional republic. In front of me, I've got many books. One book in particular that I just devoured and am devouring is Saving the Constitution by Dr. Richard Proctor. Why is this important today? Because we would not be in the soup that we're in if we would just simply follow the Constitution of the United States. Simple as that. I have marked, and I shouldn't say marked, I've bookmarked, this book in so many places. You know, look, the Constitution has only 4,694 words. It was written on one piece of parchment, so each word and each punctuation mark was very important. The founders, the authors, did not include any word that was not necessary. So when we read the document, each word must be considered. The word such as or indicates there is another thought. The word such as and means the following is included with the previous concept. A phrase such as judicial power shall would indicate a precise intention. I'll also say the number of words in the amendments, the total word count of the amendments, 3,337. Those amendments are officially considered part of the Constitution, of the document. The total number of words, if written in an average book, would be about the size of a short pamphlet of about 30 pages. It's not a huge undertaking to read the Constitution. How many of you have? How many of us have? We talk about it. We make reference to it. But do you really know it? Have you really read it? Well, Dr. Richard Proctor, the program, or the links to his website, his books, in the program description box at HagmanReportLive.com. Folks, please do me a favor. At least pick up Saving the Constitution. A Constitution, if you can keep it, as well. And any number of his books. I've got the Liberty Will It Survive, Volumes 1 through 6. Oh, how great. The Bathroom Economics. A Constitution, if you can keep it, and In Front of Me, Saving the Constitution. And I want to tell you something. It never in our history, I believe in the history of our country, has been more important for us, for you and me, to understand the Constitution. So please, get your copy, Saving the Constitution. Eric the Tech, you want to ring forth the website of, say, what website? What's the website's name? I'm sorry? I know. I wanted you to say, but sorry, because people were asking. Provis Institute.com. I'm going to say it one more time. Provis, P-R-O-V-I-S, Institute.com. There, saving the Constitution should be on everyone's coffee table, in your hands, next on your nightstand. It's that important. It's that good. With that, Dr. Richard Proctor. Doctor, thanks for coming on again today.
Tickled to be here. Tickled to be here, Doug.
I didn't mean to cut in your time, Doctor. I just.
Oh, no. You did a good ad. I appreciate that.
Okay. Well, you know, I believe in this. You know, the Constitution is so important as a founding document, and it's really kind of the way we should be adhering to things in this country, and we're not. And the reason we're in the soup today is because we're so far away from our founding document. It's incredible. And so I'm going to just, I know that we're going to talk about Article 2 of the Constitution.
Article 3 today. I prepared Article 3.
Article 3. Yeah, my mistake. I can't even read my own writing. I'm telling you. What's wrong with me? I can't read. Anyway. Welcome back, and let's rock and roll.
Let's rock and roll, yes. Kevin brought up some things this week. He and I were chatting on the phone, and he brought up some items, and I think maybe it would be judicial just to discuss these interesting sequences, okay? You've heard the term authority versus power. Now, what the heck does that mean? You know, I've got the authority to write a book, okay, because I just did it. I got the authority to do that. The president has authority to do executive orders? No, he does not. Sorry, he does not. He has the power to do executive orders. The Constitution doesn't give him any lawmaking capability at all. The Supreme Court, they set the law, don't they? No, they do not. Constitution says the law. Supreme Court just does it because they can, and they have the power to do it, and we give them the power. We give them the power. A very, very recent one, instances where they decided that the marriage thing had to change, and everybody had to allow anybody to get married who wanted to. And they decide, everybody says, oh, that's the supreme law of the land now. We've got to do it. Young lady named Kim Davis says, no, it's not. That's in Kentucky. She was supposed to do it. I was supposed to sign the document. Supposed to sign the marriage certificate. She says, I will not. They threw her in jail. Not for very long, but they did. They had the power to throw her in jail. She was following the law. The judge should have been thrown in jail. He's the guy who violated the Constitution and the law.
You know, thank you for that. I don't mean to overtalk you or interject something, but
right.
I want to remind our listeners and viewers that, folks, remember Coach Dave Dobmeier. I'm speaking in the royal sense, but Coach Dave Dobmeier went to Kim Davis's aid. Folks, we had Coach on discussing this very issue at the time it happened. We discussed and I accompanied Dave Dobmeier in front of the Supreme Court to pray against the Obergefell decision, which is really no law. It's a decision. But anyway, I just want to remind people that we were there, or Coach Dave Dobmeier was there, CoachDaveLive.com. And of course, he suffered immensely from it, from the left wing sites like Right Wing Watch. Hey, Kyle, how you doing? And others. So, thank you, Dr. Proctor, for bringing that up. Yes, it's, wow. Okay, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, we get this idea of authority and power mixed up. Power is the gun, right? It's the end of a gun. You do it or we'll throw you in jail. We'll shoot you. We'll hang you. That's power. Authority is, oh, I have the authority to do this, therefore I will. I do not have the authority, therefore I won't. Authority is something authorized by the contract, the Constitution. Power is something you take upon yourself. And the Supreme Court did that the first time in 1803. They took upon themselves the power to control the federal government. Now, people don't think of it that way, but that's what happened. In 1803, the case Marbury versus Madison, our buddy John James Marshall wrote in that decision I'm not going to be absolutely perfect, so don't quote it perfect, but it's the idea. Any law passed by Congress that's not in accordance with the Constitution is null and void. Therefore, we will determine what's constitutional or not by using judicial review, and we'll decide what's constitutional of the laws of the country. Now, that's circular reasoning. The first thing he said was, anything not in the Constitution is null and void. And then he turned right around and said something that's not in the Constitution. Therefore, that's null and void also. But nobody reads it that way. But that's the fact. That's the fact. So, we have a guy who says, I know better what the laws of the land should be based on the Constitution. And we will decide. Congress can pass a law if they want to. President can sign it if they want to. But we'll decide whether or not it can exist. And that's completely unconstitutional and has been since 1803. That's 217 years we've been allowing the Supreme Court to control our federal government. The most powerful nine guys are those guys in robes. They decide what the law is. They decide whether or not the president did something that was right or wrong. They decide. It was Bush and Kerry, wasn't it, back in that election when Florida was having a problem with did they punch the holes out or did they not?
Bush and Gore.
And they took.
Yeah.
It was, okay, Gore. Yeah, Bush and Gore. And they took it to the Supreme Court. What? It's not anything to do with the Supreme Court. That's a state law. The federal law does not reach the state law. That's a state law. State decided, state's it, that's it. No, there's any way to supersede the state. They said that Bush got the votes. And they had to look that thing over for what, 3-4 weeks? They had to look at it before they finally decided that he did. And they had to go to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court had nothing to do with it. We say this all the time. Well, let's go to the Supreme Court. They can decide. What? Let's go to the third article. Precisely. Let's go to the third article precisely here.
All right.
If the guys are in their constitutions, they're going to be on the first page after the second article finishes.
Okay.
Anyway, I thought I'd say that.
Okay.
All right. Now, here we go. Here we go. Page 12 in my little book, my little pamphlet. Article 3, Section 1, the first three words. You mentioned them earlier, Doug. The judicial power.
Mm-hmm.
Section 2, first three words. The judicial power. Repeated precisely. Maybe it's important. In Section 1, it's deciding what courts there are. And it says that there's going to be one Supreme Court. Oh, and by the way, I may not have mentioned this, but I will today. The word supreme is never capitalized in the Constitution. Never, ever. It's a hierarchy position, not a title. It just puts that court above the inferior courts. And what are the inferior courts? The inferior courts are courts that Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. So Congress establishes an inferior court, and it starts with a little I, inferior. And the Supreme Court decided it was set up by the Constitution. And that's a little s. So we have an order here. Supreme, little s, is over the inferior, little I. But they're all federal courts and have nothing to do with the state. And that's very important. You don't go to the state doesn't go to the federal government to ask if it's okay that they open and close the door. It's not the way it works. The state decides. The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and such inferior courts. The judicial power of the United States. That means of the federal government. It does not mean every state in the country. It means the federal government.
Okay.
Then it goes on and says, the judges, both of the supreme and inferior courts, shall hold their offices during good behavior, shall, at stated times, receive for their services a compensation. do you realize it does not say in that section that they're in for life? It does not say that. It just says they're in their good behavior. But it does not say that it's a lifetime commitment.
Interesting.
They don't have to be impeached. The president just has to say, and the Senate has to agree, that we're going to, this judge is finished, we'll release this judge. And he can. And if the Supreme Court, the Senate says yes, then he's released. That's the authority of the judge. That's who decides the judges. The president nominates, and the president and the Senate approves. Mm-hmm. Vice, the other way around, is the president says, well, he's done a good job, but he's past 90 years old and he can't get out of bed without help. Let's release him. And the Senate can go along or not. It's their choice.
Okay.
And then it goes on and says he's going to get paid for doing the job. And it won't ever be less while he's in, well, from when he starts to when he finishes, it'll never be less. Of course, it's never less anyway.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's all Section 1 sets up the courts, federal courts only, not the state courts.
Just to be clear, Doctor, my question,
yeah.
When you say federal courts, does that obviously especially includes the Supreme Court, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Especially includes the Supreme Court, federal court. It includes all of the federal courts that are spread out all over the nation, 3,500 of them
Right. Spread
out all over the nation.
Okay.
Those are all inferior federal courts and have nothing to do with the laws in any state or the Constitution in any state and nothing to do with the laws of the federal government either. Let's read that. Let's read in Section 2. This is the key section of Article 3 right here. Again, we start out, the judicial power shall extend to all cases, not just some of them, all of them, in law and equity, okay, arising under this Constitution. Law and equity means stuff passed by the House and the Senate, Congress, signed by the President. The laws of the United States and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority. That's the same thing that it says in almost word for word as it says in Article 6.
Okay.
The Constitution is first, the laws of the United States, passed by Congress, is second, and treaties is third, but the treaties shall be made under their authority, which we know means the authority of the Constitution and the laws. So if the treaty is not in accordance with the Constitution and the laws, it's not valid. And that's one area where it's been repeated twice. That whole sentence, they really meant it. They repeated it twice. Now, what are the cases? It goes on now and describes the cases. All cases, remember, and it says to all cases affecting. Now, here's the list of the cases. Ambassadors and other public ministers and consuls.
Right.
Admiralty and maritime jurisdiction.
Right.
Controversies to which the United States shall be a party.
Okay.
Controversies between two or more states. Between a state and the citizens of another state. Between citizens of different states. Between citizens of the same state claiming lands under grants of different states. And between a state or the citizens thereof and foreign states. Foreign states, citizens, or subjects. You notice there's nothing in the judicial power of the Congress that allows them to look at any law passed by the Congress and signed by the President. It's not there.
All right. So, okay, if you don't mind, repeat that sentence again. There's nothing.
There's nothing in the Constitution. This is Section 2.
Right.
It's their authority. Judicial power shall extend to all cases. So these are the cases he can do, and there are 8 of them when you put them all down in an outline form,
right,
which I've done in my book, Saving the Constitution. Anyway, there's no place in those 8 items that gives the Supreme Court any power over any state law, any power over any state constitution, any power over laws passed by Congress and signed by the President. None at all.
Wow. Okay.
It's all controversies, you know. Not every one of them, but it's controversies affecting ambassadors, controversies between the United States, controversies between two or more, between citizens. It's all controversies. In other words, cases, law cases, judge cases, controversies. No decision-making power at all about any law passed anywhere in the whole country. They assume that power, and we let them have it. So therefore, when they say black is white, we say, okay, that's the supreme law of the land. Black is white. From now on, black is white. There's no more black, just white. Because white is white and black is white. That's a decision they make. Doesn't make it law, does it? Doesn't change anything. Gravity. Nope, we're going to decide against gravity. Gravity is a bad thing. We don't want gravity. It hurts people when they fall out of a window on a fourth-story building. It hurts them. We don't want people to be hurt. That's disability stuff. That's bad. We don't want them to be hurt. Therefore, we're going to decree that gravity doesn't exist. So Supreme Court makes a decision, gravity doesn't exist, so therefore it doesn't exist, right? So I can step out the fourth-story window, and I won't fall, because the Supreme Court said it. That's the kind of power we have given the Supreme Court. I know those examples were stupid, okay, obvious, but that's what we've done. That's what we've done.
In my view, no more ignorant, stupid, or than... you know, infanticide or killing an unborn child or allowing a man or allowing a same-sex marriage or whatever you call that. That's ridiculous. As ridiculous as
your
example. Yes.
Indeed. Yes, it is. It is as ridiculous as saying gravity doesn't work. It is. Because it's not true. People are people. Men are men. Women are women. And that's that. Okay? And I don't care if everybody thinks, well, I feel like this. I don't care what you feel like. Depending on your biological stats person, you are a boy or a girl, and that's that. And no law, no rule, no nothing can alter it.
That's right.
It's the way it is. I don't know why we can't get that through our heads. Now, you went back to abortion. Remember this, very important, that the Declaration of Independence is the foundation of our country. The Constitution is how to put in place the foundation of the Constitution. And everybody is entitled to life, liberty, life. Everybody's entitled to life.
That's right.
And it doesn't say birth. It says created. It just says life. We're all life. Everybody's created equal. It doesn't say we're born equal. It says we're created equal. Therefore, life in the womb is life. It's been created already. The child has been created. It's just developing in the womb. Life is a guarantee. So we just murdered 60 million kids. Now, if the child is born and the mother treats it badly and it dies, they'll persecute the mother for doing it. But if she goes to the doctor and the doctor tears the kid apart in the womb, then nobody's to blame. This is a terrible decision. I can't imagine that we are intelligent people that we will put up with that kind of thing. I can't imagine that we allow these people to call themselves Planned Parenthood are allowed to teach, preach, and push abortion, the murder of children.
Amen.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm not sorry.
Don't be sorry. Huh?
Don't be sorry. Yeah. Yes.
Well, I'm really not sorry. I'm just so firm on this subject. It's so firm. It's so obvious. It's not hidden. It's not hidden at all. So the Supreme Court decides that's okay. Back in 72, they didn't have any authority to do that. They had no authority to do it. But everybody thinks they did, and everybody lives it that way. In fact, when you look back in 1972, there was no law in the United States or in the federal government that allowed abortions. No law allowed them at all. But when that decision, which was not a law, came out, everybody said, oh, then all the laws are struck down and now it's okay to do it. No. No laws were struck down. The decision was given. that Congress should have said null and void. By the way, here's another thing. We're looking now at the second paragraph of Section 2. I'm going to go to the last part of it. The Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, with such exceptions, and exceptions is capitalized, with such exceptions and under such regulations, and regulations is capitalized, as the Congress shall make. What that says is the Supreme Court acts under the authority of the Congress, and the Congress tells them what they can do and can't do. So the Congress's right place in 1972 was to say, Supreme Court, you cannot do that. That's not within your authority. We're going to take that out of your power. You cannot do that. And that's their authority to do it, and they did not. But they should have. Because their laws said it. Their laws already said it was against the law. They should have just said, I'm sorry, Supreme Court, the law is the law. You just gave a decision, and it's not valid. They had a law on the books that they ignored, set aside. Congress decides the exceptions and the regulations of the Supreme Court.
Right.
But they don't do it.
And by virtue of not enforcing enforcing the tenets of the Constitution, we the people, and others we've allowed this to happen.
Yes, yes, we've given tacit authority because we don't act. That's authority. We don't act. We are the authority. The people are the authority. Since the people don't act, they have given tacit agreement.
Okay.
And there's enough people in this country that are against abortion and against same-sex marriage and against all this stuff to have said, hey, this is wrong, we're not going to do that. And every time a state tries to do that so far, the Supreme Court has struck it down. They don't have any power to do that. But everybody, oh, well, the Supreme Court did it, it's okay. Oh, yes, it must be right, the Supreme Court said it, oh my, it's not right.
Well, as you point out in your book, Saving the Constitution, folks, again, I would urge everyone to get a copy of this because this is so enlightening, up to date, and it's like a 44 Magnum in your hand, at your fingertips. You write this: at this point, we must get an understanding of the difference between the case law and common law. Common law is God's law or nature's law and doesn't change. And I think that fits here. I mean, of all things, it fits here.
Yes. Code law and common law is your main key. Code law changes as the judges choose to do it. Common law is firm.
Right.
And that's how we should look at it. Now, if we go into the next one, it talks about the trial of all cases, of all crimes, except in the cases of impeachment, shall be by jury. Now, what does that say? All crimes? In other words, a crime in the state of Arizona, that's dictating this, the crime in the state of Arizona? That doesn't dictate it, except in Article 6, it says that we're going to uphold the Constitution. Therefore, that indirectly says that the state is required to try all crimes with a jury also. Even though this is a federal contract, because they agree, that says that the states will do it also. You have to be careful about those kinds of things. It is a federal document. This is a statement, a trial of all crimes shall be by jury.
Okay.
That means that all crimes, federal and state, but it's an indirect statement on the states. It's a positive statement in the federal.
Okay.
Just a thought.
All right.
Now it goes on and it explains about the states. Such trial shall be held in the state where this crime was committed. You see, now we've put it right to the states. It is its part of the state. That's not implied. That says it is.
Okay.
And when not committed within a state, it shall take place wherever Congress, by law, says it will.
And I don't know quite. Okay, and to remind people, we're talking about Article 3, Section 2, Paragraph 3.
Yes.
Okay.
Article 3, Section, Paragraph 3, yes. It's talking about our right for trials.
Okay.
All crimes, except in the case of impeachment, shall be by jury. This is a federal document. But at the same time, the states are sworn to uphold it. So even though that right there is an implication, they went on to clarify it and say those trials shall be held in the state where the crime was done.
Right.
That's not a hard question. And no. You can extradite from one state to the other based on that.
Correct.
And it's a proper thing. The states decide. Does it say that after the state decides, it's going to go to the federal government to decide again? No, it does not say that. It says the state's going to try it where the crime's committed.
All right.
It only says if it's not committed within a state, and that must mean territory, area, jurisdiction of the country, the trial shall be at a place or places, as Congress can say, by law.
Right.
But since we don't have any, well, I guess Puerto Rico is one of those, and maybe Guam. So maybe we have some spots like that.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Now, Section 3. It doesn't start with the judicial power. Wow, how about that? It talks about treason. Treason against the United States. This defines what treason is. Notice what it says. Shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. Now, what did that say about treason? We talk about the president or the judge or whatever, some person being treasonous. Treason against the United States only in levying war against them. It's a wartime item. Treason is a war crime, not a crime, but you don't really have treason unless you're violating giving aid to the enemy of a war. That's what Section 3 starts out saying.
You have to, if you're an enemy, that means we must be at war or be on a war footing, right? I mean...
Except it has to be declared by Congress, and we haven't had one of those done since the World War II.
Correct. Okay.
So there's no treason at all anywhere, because these are all police operations. There's no treason.
Interesting. Okay.
Fascinating, isn't it?
It is.
You've got to put all the stuff together.
Okay.
So since there's no war, we can't have treason today. Now, we can have high crimes and misdemeanors, like it says in Section 4 of Article 2. But not treason. Treason is during wartime. A declared wartime, in fact.
With a declared enemy. Right.
Yes, with a declared enemy.
Yeah, an identified enemy has been. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I'm following this.
Yeah, how can you adhere to an enemy if you haven't identified the enemy?
That's right.
Who is it? Identify it. Now we know who it is, giving them, the enemy that's been declared, aid and comfort. You see, it's very well defined.
Right.
If you just read the whole document together.
Okay.
No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or confession in open court. So you can't be convicted of treason unless two people say that's what happened in the same act.
Isn't that interesting? Where have we heard multiple witnesses before in a inerrant document book? Okay. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Anyway, so there we have witnesses. Got to have at least two. Can have more. Can't do it on one. Got to have two. And it's got to be the same act. Can't combine acts.
Right.
Now, the second paragraph in 3, the Congress shall have power to declare the punishment of treason. Okay, there we have it. Punishment of treason. Congress has power to declare the punishment. But you can only do that in wartime, remember?
Right.
No attenter of the treason shall work corruption of blood. Oh, dear me. Attenter of treason. Oh, dear me. Oh, no, it's not attenter of treason. Attenter of treason.
You know, I have a question mark. I have a question mark next to that phrase in my book here, Saving the Constitution, because I need some assistance on that, and I'm sure a lot of people might. Okay, what does that mean?
Yes, I'm going to read in the book with you.
Okay.
Blooming pages won't turn. These new books. I don't even have a new book. I keep special books that I always get into, but this one, the page won't turn. There we go. The Tenter of Treason. Page 127, 128, and 130, and I'm in Keep It. 127, 128, and 130. So let's go to those pages and see exactly what I've written in there. I don't want to say something I haven't written exactly. Okay. 27 and 28. Here we are. Now we're on 27. Two witnesses. All right, the Tenter of Treason. Now we're in paragraph 3. Two or more, paragraph 3, a tender of treason. The definition is on page 128, a tender of treason. Now, I want to go through this exactly how I've written. What does no a tender of treason mean? The guilty is the shall work corruption of blood. Corruption of blood is precisely the person that's guilty. The person that's guilty is the person that's punished. Not the family, not the grandchildren, not anybody. A tenter of treason, you know, I'm sorry. I put that paragraph all together. And in reality, that paragraph sentence has two. I didn't define a tenter of treason. That's terrible.
Gotcha. But I
only defined corruption of blood.
And to be clear, corruption of blood is meaning the sins of the father will not be cast upon the sins of the son. I'm saying the sins of the father, or vice versa. In other words, the guilty person, not the family, not the Uncle Ed or whatever. It's the guilty party or the person that's found.
Yes.
Okay, I got you.
Exactly right. Now, right. I'm going here to. I'm not going to be able to do it right there. I'm looking for my copy of 1812 dictionary. 1828 dictionary. 1828. Let me do it. It's be right here. Webster's Dictionary of 1828. And we're going to go to a tenter of treason. A-T-T. Let me get the spelling right. Don't want to mess it up. A-I-N. D-E-R. Attainder. Okay, they did it that way. Okay, let's look it up. See what it says.
All right.
Literally, a staining or corruption or rendering corruption of blood. It's a part of corruption of blood. Attainder means literally a staining or a corruption.
Interesting.
So it does come together as one thing. Demonstrated by the act of attainting. Let me see what that says. It's nice to have these dictionaries right handy. An act was made for the attainder of several persons. No crime words and attainder. No crime. Note, by the Constitution of the United States, no crime words and attainder. It's got to be a combination together, the whole thing, because it's a staining. Literally, it's a staining or a corruption. So, a tenter of treason or corruption of blood is one phrase meaning only that the family is not to be punished by a crime somebody else did.
It makes
and
sense.
He goes on to say,
yeah.
He goes on to say, now I'm reading in definition 2 of a tender. The judgment of death or sentence of a competent tribunal upon a person convicted of treason or felony, which judgment taints or corrupts his blood. See that what taints or corrupts his blood. That's the same, different ways of saying the same thing, so that he can no longer inherit lands. The consequences of this judgment are forfeiture of lands, tenements, and hereditaments, loss of reputation, and disqualification to be a witness in any court of law. a statute of Parliament attaining a criminal is called an act of attainder. So the sentence seems to be in the attainder, but it does not go on to any other part of the family. It's a little complicated word, but the phrase is the complete phrase means that nobody else is tainted or in any way found guilty of the crime the other person committed.
As well as it should be. And that's, yes. And that's a, if I believe that to be a biblical concept, I could be wrong, but I suspect that that's a biblical concept.
I would think so, but I don't remember. I couldn't give a reference, but I'd be sure it is.
Yeah, yeah. Nor could I, but okay.
Yeah. Anyway, so you asked a question about a tender, and I hadn't done it, but then I looked in the dictionary, and I had done it because I'd read other articles about it, but I hadn't looked in the dictionary for positive in this case, and I just did. And anybody can read it with me if they want to. All they have to do is have a copy of the 1828 dictionary available. Sometimes they're not available. Anyway, yes, good. So that's that attenter of blood, attenter to treason, no attenter of treason shall work corruption of blood, which means no taint, stain of treason shall work on any other part of the family. And that applies to all crime, not just treason.
Okay. All right. And that makes sense. Perfect sense. All right.
Did you ask that question? It wasn't clear. Now everybody who's listening will know what it means exactly. Maybe. This is very complicated stuff when you get right down to this kind of detail.
Well, you know, I think it's been, it could be me, but I think it's been made complicated. When we start changing the definition of words, as we have, one example, gay, okay, we change that definition, okay? Since when does gay mean homosexual? And yet you can look in the dictionary, more recent dictionary, especially the urban online dictionaries, and see that gay means refers to homosexual. It's so, folks, I mean, this is why words are important. So anyway.
That's the change of language, isn't
yes.
it? It's the change of language.
It's a hijacking.
That's why when we look at the Constitution, we have to look at a dictionary of the era. That's why I didn't go to Webster's Dictionary of today. No. Went to Webster's Dictionary of 1828.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what you have to do.
Absolutely. Okay.
Now we go on to, we continue on here. The Congress shall have power to declare the punishment of treason. And again it says, but no attenter of treason shall work corruption of blood or forfeiture except in the life of the person tainted. Attainted.
Right.
Yep. Right. There's the key. No corruption of blood except during the life of the person attainted or tainted or stained with the crime.
And there's a period there.
Yes.
So
there's a period.
Okay.
And the phrase, no attenter of treason shall work corruption of blood, is a full phrase between the commas.
That's right.
Those commas are important, as you discussed just a few minutes ago in Article 5. The or matters.
Yes.
The or, comma, matters. But anyway, so that's Article 3. Kind of as clear as I wanted to do it and help people understand. The most important part of Article 3 is Section 2, Paragraph 1. That is the most important part. Paragraph 2 talks about jurisdiction. The Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction. The Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. Okay, now let's read it how it says it exactly. Those cases, I had to add the word cases in, but that's what it means. Those cases, in all cases, and in those cases, in which a state shall be a party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. But it has to be cases that are a part of Section 2. Because that's what the cases are. All cases are listed in Section 2. But notice in some of those, between state, between the citizens of another state, between citizens of different states, can go to the Supreme Court. Those kinds of cases tried in the state can go to the Supreme Court as a original jurisdiction. they belong there. Those in which a state shall be a party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. In all other cases before mentioned, notice the before mentioned, that means that stuff in Section 2, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact. The Supreme Court has appellate.
So what you're saying, they would be the ultimate arbiters of cases that you described. The ultimate... Okay, I got you.
The cases which were in a state, and they tried them in a state, but it's one of those kinds of things that can be... It is a part of Section 2. Therefore, they have appellate jurisdiction. But it has to be cases before mentioned. It isn't every case, just cases before mentioned. And the cases before mentioned are the eight we listed in Section 2.
And so, just so I'm clear, those eight types of cases define the venue, the role of the Supreme Court. Anything else?
Yes.
Okay, so anything outside of that, wow, okay, outside of those specific types of cases, the Supreme Court does not have the authority to hear. Is that correct?
That's right. Doesn't have the authority, not appellate, not any authority to hear it. That's right, none.
Interesting.
Just those things that are listed in Section 2, those eight items, some of them will originate in the states because of the way it was said, and states have to have the crimes in their state, the crimes committed in their state. But that can go to the Supreme Court in an appellate jurisdiction.
Okay. All right. Yep, I can see where and this makes all the difference in the world when we're talking about Supreme Court cases, whether it's Roe v. Wade or a Obergefell decision. Do they even have the authority to make decisions on that? Question mark. Okay, that's good.
No, they don't. They don't have authority on it at all. It's not a law. You've got to have law. Notice it always says in law, in fact.
Yes.
In law. It always says in law.
Right. All right.
By law. Everything says by law. By law. Law and equity. If it's not a proper law, if it's not a law, they have no jurisdiction at all. Nobody does.
You know, folks, I mean, see how perverted everything has become, and we have allowed it to become. And I would say Dr. Proctor is pointing out this perversion, and the reference material that we're looking at is Saving the Constitution. Of course, the Constitution itself, but Saving the Constitution by Dr. Richard Proctor. I highly recommend getting it, provostinstitute.com. That's provostinstitute.com. It'll be in the program description box at HagmanReportLive.com. Order it tonight. Seriously, get it right away while you can, because... this is important.
I'm running out of books. You realize I had to put in another order today for another several hundred books. I'm running out of books.
Well, I hope we had something to do with that. I hope this program has
Yes,
something.
Yes, you did. Absolutely. I wasn't running out of books until Wednesday last week.
well, I got mine, folks. And let me tell you, it's you know what? I gotta say this. I have to give you a lot of credit because, you know, I consider myself an intelligent guy, okay, but the language used at the time of the drafting of the Constitution is just a tad different than we use today, obviously. But you make it so easy, so simple for us to understand, and I thank you for that.
Well, that was the goal of this book. I don't write, like I've said several times in places, I don't know, I can't use a word that has more than two syllables. So since I can't do anything with more than two syllables, it's relatively easy to understand. I never use anti-disestablishmentarianism in any of my books.
Well, you know, I think most of us are polysyllabic averse, you know?
Polysyllabic or monosyllabic, right?
Exactly.
What fun. Anyway, see, so that's pretty much Article 3. Now, last week, you recommended that people ask questions.
Yes.
And I don't know if any came in, but there could be some questions about Article 3 that we've discussed today. Send them in. We'll talk about those.
Okay. Yeah, I'm having them gathered as we speak. I should have had that done earlier, but that's being done.
Go ahead, and if you've got them handy, let's discuss them.
I'm actually having them assembled, like I said, as we speak. I should have had that done.
Okay.
But actually, Kevin had His entire, Kevin, thank you very much. The basis of his question was about this very issue, power versus authority. So I appreciate that. So, okay.
Yeah, he brought that up when we were chatting. So I thought that's a good thing.
Yes.
Here's some other little items. I like to, well, it's almost time to end for the hour, isn't it?
And we got about 2 minutes. Yes.
Oh, about 2 minutes. Okay. Well, let me see. I'm just going to make a statement here and we'll discuss it later. How long was the Revolutionary War? How long was the Revolutionary War? When did it start and when did it end? That's the question to ponder.
Okay.
I mean, we know that it started in 1776, the Battle of Concord and Lexington. We know that's where it started. When did it end? Just an interesting thought. Did it end in 1881 when the peace treaty was signed? When did the Revolutionary War end? What do everybody think about that? Well, you're doing your advertising and helping your people and helping people buy the things that they should buy from your organization.
All right. Well, then you know what? We're going to take a network break right now. What timing? How great is that timing? Dr. Proctor, you must have a program clock in front of you. I thank you for that.
I do. Yeah,
okay.
I do.
All right. Well, you know, and that's a great question to ponder as we go out to break and come back here in about 3 minutes. Folks, you're listening to the Hagman Report. My guest, what a fine and very articulate gentleman, Dr. Richard Proctor, provisinstitute.com, where you can find a number of books, including Saving the Constitution, A Constitution If You Can Keep It, and so many others. Going to be right back. You're listening to the Hagman Report. Stay right where you're at.
Reporting on what the mainstream media won't, you're listening to the Hagman and Hagman Report on the Global Star Radio Network.
Exposing the New World Order, you're listening to the Hagman and Hagman Report on the Global Star Radio Network. Stand by. Doug and Joe will be back shortly.
And welcome back to the Hagman Report, where truth can't be silenced. HagmanReportLive.com. That's HagmanReportLive.com. HagmanReportLive.com. That's where you're going to find all of our audio, video assets, program descriptions, links to important articles, and most importantly today, links to Saving the Constitution by Dr. Richard Proctor, a book that I highly recommend, as well as A Constitution If You Can Keep It. That's, I'm telling you. And then if you really want to get into some good stuff, I mean some really good stuff, the series Liberty Will It Survive by Dr. Proctor, there's 6 volumes to that. And you know, I just kind of just went through a couple of them, and man, it's really good. It all ties together. And of course, Dr. Proctor's, he's an expert on economics. Bathroom Economics is a book So there's, and easily understood economics. That's really a key book as well. So a lot of good reference material. And I want to thank Dr. Proctor as well for being such a gracious guest and coming and educating us, because folks, we see, just real quick here, we see a lot of things being perverted. And I want to caution people just very quickly here, because I know that there is a cause celeb out there. There's a case right now that originated in Wisconsin. It has to do with, it involves a whole boatload of people. Okay. You know what I'm talking about. I'm not going to name names, but it originates in Wisconsin. It's ending up in Florida. And there is this, I have never seen such a perversion of language, a perversion of common sense, or an absence of common sense, and a perversion of the Constitution than these mopes and muppets, in my view, who are handling this or attempting to handle this. And if that is harsh, then so be it. We have with me, I believe, the I don't think I'm overstating this. We have a foremost expert in the Constitution, and that's Dr. Richard Proctor. And I'm telling you, and about the, what I just mentioned earlier, folks, look, the gold fringe on the flag, it's a decoration. It doesn't mean anything more than that. Because I don't want the emails. I don't want the comments. Okay, so understand that. So there's a lot of misconception and a lot of perversion going on, and the only thing I got to say is stop it. Before I get back to Dr. Richard Proctor, I want to tell you this. It is time your furniture matched your fearless style. And I'm fearless. I know you're fearless. Your furniture should suit your needs, but also feel uniquely you. That's where Joybird comes in. They've got endless customizable options, which means that the days for settling what you have in your living room, your den, your office, they're over. Now, with Joybird. And folks, have you heard about Joybird? I hope you have. With Joybird, your personal one-of-a-kind style should match your furniture. And I know with me, it does. I've got just a wonderful sofa, couch in my office. And, I designed it. It matches my style. I designed it. I had everything to say about it from start to finish. You can bring your mood boards to life with hundreds of customizable pieces, over 50 fabric and leather options, 3 shades of wood, over 250 unique silhouettes, from rich buttery leathers to the softest materials you've ever felt. You're sure to find the fabric and texture that's right for you with free fabric swatch kits. See and touch all of the fabrics to find the perfect choice. They offer, and this is important to me, they offer a range of kid and pet-friendly upholstery options so your creations can stand the test of time. Just, you know what, just have a police officer with all of his gear take a nap on your sofa and see what happens if you're not using Joybird. Each Joybird-produced piece is made with the ultimate care and precision, using real wood without all of those harmful chemicals and responsibly sourced materials. And all Joybird handcrafted pieces come from or come with a limited lifetime warranty, 365-day home trial. Skip the furniture store. Bring the showroom home. Sit on it. Sleep on it. Break it in. If you don't love your Joybird, return it. Here's what you need to do. The fine folks at Joybird work this out with the Hagman Report. Create furniture that matches your own fearless style at joybird.com/Hagman. That's 2 N's on Hagman, H-A-G-M-A-N-N. It's on your screen right there. See how Joybird can make that dream space a reality today at joybird.com/Hagman. Go to Joybird, J-O-Y-B-I-R-D, joybird.com/Hagman, and receive an exclusive offer for 25% off your first order by using the code Hagman. 25% off. You can't, folks, do it today. joybird.com/Hagman. Use promo code Hagman for 25% off your first order. You know, and by the way, check out HagmanStore.com as well. HagmanStore.com as well. In addition to gourmet coffee that supports legitimate organizations, Russ Dizdar's, we provide proceeds to Russ Dizdar and Craig Sawyer, who are actually on the ground fighting, boots on the ground, to fighting human and child sex trafficking. In addition to our coffee, what a shirt Eric has designed and made. Oh my goodness. Check it out. Go to HagmanStore.com. Actually, they're flying off of the, the internet shelves. There it is right there on your screen. Hagman Report. HagmanStore.com. Good looking shirts. All right. Dr. Richard Proctor, ProvisInstitute.com. That's where you need to go. And again, saving the Constitution. If you're not going to order one today or tomorrow, I don't know what to tell you because you need to have this. This is one of the, seriously, you know how much I like to read. This book has made the Constitution easy for me to understand. That's Saving the Constitution. Dr. Proctor, thanks for holding over and thanks for your patience with me as I stumble through the initial, the outro and intro. I apologize for taking so much time.
That's right. Back to the Revolutionary War.
Yes. Eric the Tech was saying, what do you think the answer is? And I've got an answer in my mind, but I don't want to embarrass myself, so go ahead.
I won't ask. You're probably absolutely right. The Revolutionary War did have a treaty cessing it, or stopping it, in 1781. But all the way through the rest of the 1700s and into the beginning of the 1800s, we were continuing to fight that war economically.
Economically, yep.
Economically. Let me explain some of the things that happened during that period. It's all outlined very nice in a book called The Coming Battle, published in 18... Am I getting the right book here in mind? I think so. No, it's not. It's not in that book. It's in a book published by Ron Carter. And it's a book called Prelude to Glory. And the eighth volume of his book discusses this very well. So if you're interested, that's how to find the details. But think about this. This is what happened during that war, during that period. First, the Revolutionary War soldiers all went home. They were done. They were finished. And they got paid in scrip, which was absolutely worthless. They couldn't buy anything with it. So they went to the banks and they said, banks, you know we're good for it. We've been on this land for our whole family's been on this land. We need to plant our crops so that we can get started again after the war's over. So the banks in the United States agreed.
Mm-hmm.
You pay us when you sell your product. And then we're happy. And then they borrowed the money in the springtime. They planted their crops, got about halfway through the season. Crops aren't ready to be sold yet. They're not ready to be harvested. Halfway through the season, Bank of England decided that they wanted all the loans paid in specie, gold and silver. If you didn't have gold and silver, you couldn't pay the loan. All the loans were called by the Bank of England. And then the banks, our banks, had to call them here. So they went to the people and they says, I know we agreed to this, but our loan's been called by the Bank of England and we've got to pay it. And it's got to be in gold and silver. The farmer said, we don't have any gold and silver. We don't have anything of any value except our crop and it's only half done. You got to do it. And the farmers, the revolutionary soldiers and families lost their land because the Bank of England foreclosed on their properties and they lost them. Sheriffs came in and expelled people. The sheriff had to do it. That was the law. Had to do it. The Bank of England continued to rage that war against us economically for the whole 20 years up until the late 1800s. 1808, 1809, that kind of thing. They continued an economic battle to destroy our country. In addition, the men of war ships from England would stop commercial ships of the United States on the high seas and impress the sailors. They'd take them off the ship and put them as slaves on the British ship, literally. And that was going on. Terrible problem. So here we have the war continuing economically and individually on the high seas. And that went on until 1812, when the United States and England went back to war again. Now, why did they go back to war again in 1812? Here's an interesting sequence of events. The Constitution was ratified in 1788. The first Bank of the United States was organized in 1791 in violation of Paragraph 5, Article 1, Section 8, because it was set up as the producer of our money and everything, and the decider of our interest rates and all that, just like the Federal Reserve does. It was a central bank, but it was controlled by the Bank of England. We're back to the Bank of England in that 1791.
Really?
Now, that bank had a charter for 20 years. And the charter ran out in 1811. That's the period of the economic war, 1791 to 1811. And the charter ran out in 11. The War of 1812 started in 12. That was with Britain. They're back on our butts again. That war ended in 1815. And the Second Bank of the United States was organized in 1816 with a 20-year charter. It's interesting to me to note that the government of the country started in 1791, and here we have a bank, a central bank under the control of the Bank of England, organized in 1791. 20-year charter, it goes away in 1811, a new war, 1812. That war goes away in 1815, and then the new bank starts in 1816, under the control of the Bank of England. Do we get a feel here of what's going on? These are not coincidences. These are planned events.
Interesting.
Bank of England controlling our country. And when they didn't have control, they went to war with us. Now, after 37, what happened? After 36, the charter ran out in 1816. Charter ran out in 1836. What happened then? Europe, Bank of England, stopped accepting our bills of credit. And we had a financial crisis in the United States in 1837. Why? Because that charter ran out. And they lost all those profits. Then we had another war in 1860 to 1864. Civil War. A lot of debt came out of the Civil War. So what happened next? 1870. We set up the corporations. I've got a big discussion about 1870 in Volume 2, the preface of Volume 2. 9 pages just talking about the stuff that happened in 1870.
I saw that because that's relevant to some today. Okay, thank you.
Yes.
All right.
That's the corporation. That's when we became a corporation.
Right.
That's when you guys are all familiar with corporations. Somebody always owned them. Stockholders own them, or the people, you know, the stockholders all own corporations. Everybody, a corporation is always owned by somebody. Corporations don't just exist. Private business is owned by the person. Partnership is owned by the partners. Corporation is owned by the stockholders, or whoever they're owned by somebody.
Right.
So, United States set up a corporation, USA Corp, 1870, and who was the owner? Bank of England comes right back in again.
Yep.
Bank of England comes right back in again. So we finished the War of Civil War, and the Bank of England takes over again in 1870. Guys, we have no idea what's going on in these. They don't tell us. They don't. You have to put things together and look at things that are happening. You have to put them together. Let's look at the Federal Reserve. What happened in the Federal Reserve? That's an interesting series of events. Again, sequences? I mean, coincidences? I don't think so. A fellow by the name of John Warburg came to the United States in 1906. He was tasked by the company Kuhn-Loeb and Company, tasked him and paid him. In today's dollar, they paid him $500,000 a year in 1906, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. $500,000 a year. How much money was that in today's dollars? today's money, so you can get an idea. $33 million a year gives you an idea of what he earned when he came working for Kuhn Loeb in the United States. Plus expenses in case that money wasn't enough. Okay, now, his purpose was to set up a central bank. That's what he was set to do. The people in the Bank of England, you see, back in the Bank of England again, Bank of England and the other major European bank, Credit Suisse, Barclays, those guys, the Rothschild banks. Anyway, they wanted this United States to have central banks again, controlled by Europe. They wanted that. It's time. So here comes Paul Warburg in 1906. He travels the country, goes everywhere. He got the power, the financial powers together at Jekyll Island in 1910. And they wrote the Federal Reserve Act. They tried to get it passed earlier, like 11, 12, couldn't get it passed because the word central bank was on it. So they changed the wording and called it the Federal Reserve Bank.
Right.
Now, we're moving into 1913, and this is a pivot year, absolute pivot year for us in this country. There were several steps they had to do. First, the very, very first step, they had to get taxes on people's incomes. They had to get taxes on government debt. They had to get people responsible for the government debt. They were planning to do a significant debt at central bank, but they had to get a way to pay the interest. So they had to get taxes on the people. So the first step was the 16th Amendment, which violates the Constitution in every word but about the first nine. Anyway, so that amendment, it was challenged in 16 and in 1916, and the Supreme Court in their wisdom said, oh yeah, it's constitutional. Anybody read it? There's nothing constitutional in that except the first few words that says Congress can levy taxes. That's the only thing that's constitutional in that whole amendment. Now, you really can't say constitutional in an amendment because the amendment was ratified and becomes a part of the Constitution. So what you have to do is you have to show the illegality of the amendment by going to the contract law and discovering what contract law says about amendments. Amendments can't change the document since the 16th Amendment changes all the document, changes every word in it, changes the document. It is illegal, therefore should be nullified by every state. Anyway, that's the 16th Amendment. Had to pass. We had to get incomes on the people to pay the debt. Now, the next problem was the senators. You see, the senators, the basic idea of the senators and the representatives. Representatives were responsible for the budget, for taxes, for the budget spend, for spending in the government. No law, let me say it this way. All laws originating to do with money must originate in the House of Representatives. That's just one of the rules of the Constitution. They must originate in the House of Representatives. So, representatives would go out to their various precincts, their districts, whatever, and talk to all the people, and the people say, we want this, we want this, we want this, we want this, we want a new bridge here, we want roads here, we want this, this, this. And they say all these things. And the representatives, they wanted to get elected.
Yep.
So they made promises. When they got back to Washington, they wrote these in bills. Everybody patted themselves on the back, passed all the bills so they could get all those people happy, and sent them on to the Senate. Now, the Senate, they represent the state. The state hires and fires them at will. Just because the term 6 years is there doesn't mean it has to be a term of 6 years. A person can resign, and the state could resign them, could fire them. Okay? And we as people in our country, we could fire them too, but nobody does. They say, he's there for 6 years and we've got to stick with him. Anyway, so here we have the senators. Now, the senators were representing the states. Now, when you read close Article 1, it says, direct taxes shall be apportioned among the states. Taxes shall be apportioned among the states. In other words, the states are going to pay taxes if the government doesn't have enough money to pay all their operation from excise taxes and the things that they're authorized to collect. So they go to the states with a direct tax. Now, the senators said to themselves, if I pass this bill, the state of Georgia is going to say, what did you do? You make me pay all, you're going to make us pay all that money, that those taxes, you're going to make us pay all those taxes, we're not going to pay them, and you're not staying there any longer. They saw the handwriting on the wall. The senators knew that the states wouldn't pay the taxes, therefore they knew that they couldn't pass those bills, and the bills were stopped in the Senate. The House members went back to the people and said, well, we tried, but those guys in the Senate, those bad guys in the Senate stopped it. It wasn't our fault, wasn't our fault. But it kept the budget somewhat under control, except in wartime. Now, I'm not saying it kept it under control. I've got another list in my economics books that shows how much debt occurred in every year of the United States since 1790 till the books were published in 15, so it only goes up to that, but I still have my charts going up to 20. Anyway, the Senate kept the debt. There was a watchdog on the debt. So we had to get the 17th Amendment passed so there wouldn't be any watchdog on the bills, so the Congress could spend whatever they wanted. And since they could spend whatever they wanted, they had to be able to pay for it, and had to do that with debt, and there'll be interest, and we've got to get the people to pay that debt and that interest. So the 17th Amendment comes in, the 16th Amendment first to get the taxes covered, and the 17th Amendment came in to get rid of the people who would stop them. Now the stage is set for the Federal Reserve. They still can't get it passed because there's a lot of people who don't want it. So they wait until it's Christmas Eve, Christmas break. And you remember, they didn't have airplanes. This is 1913. They didn't travel by airplanes. They traveled by train. They got on, many congressmen got on their train, on their cars, the train, get on the, to go home. Christmas break. And the guys who wanted the Federal Reserve didn't. Then they met, called themselves a quorum, and the quorum passed the Federal Reserve Act, signed the next day by Wilson, with no 20-year charter limit.
So
that's how that was passed.
So the charters, just to kind of bring this full circle, the charters that we witnessed as a country from the establishment of the first central bank in 1791. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So there's 20 years, 1791, and then another 20 years, 20 years expiration, war, 20 years expiration, war, and so on. And then this through the 16th and then 17th Amendment, bada bing, now we have paved the way for a full time, all the time, no expiration, central bank, Federal Reserve. There we go. All right.
And the Federal Reserve has done their job.
Which
the
is?
The Federal Reserve has done their job. Which is? Put debt on the United States.
To put debt, right. To rob us blind, basically. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
That's right.
All right.
And we need a banking system that does not include the Federal Reserve. We need that badly.
Right, right. And you're talking, of course, about Woodrow Wilson signing that and Colonel Edward Mandelhaus, folks.
Mandelhaus.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
He was the assistant president, you know.
Yes, of course. It was Wilson's brain or Wilson's alter ego. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yep. Alter ego is a good word. Absolutely. Yeah. Wilson was elected under the with the partner of House,
right.
The House is his partner.
And who wrote Philip Drew, Administrator?
Yes, that was written in 1811. Yes, mm-hmm.
Okay.
Philip Drew, Administrator. That's an interesting book too. I've read that book, reference it a lot. Yeah, this is not very long. A few pages shows how the United States becomes a socialist nation.
There you go.
And destroys the government. And we moved right along on the Philip Drew analysis. Absolutely.
And here we are.
Anyway, those are not coincidences. Those don't just happen. Nothing is a coincidence in government. Nothing is a coincidence in government. And that's where we sit, guys. Those are just a few little coincidences that are in our history, that when you put them together with the economics and the signs of the time and people that are doing things, you put them all together in one package, you can see intent by some power that we don't know about. Well, those of us who read know about it.
Yep.
It's all in my book. The Liberty Series books talks about this power and what they do and how they do it and who they are.
It's a power that has weaved its tentacles throughout history, throughout all facets of government, and it's why and where we find ourselves today. So, yes, this is absolutely, I mean, it's stuff, folks, you and I know this. We've heard this before, but to apply it in terms of the United States Constitution and how the Constitution has been perverted by this entity, and you said it last time, the power behind this, and of course people will mock, they'll scoff, they'll laugh, it's the deep state, or otherwise known as the Illuminati. So, you know, they'll mock at it, but it's evident here, and that brings forth the Council on Foreign Relations, the Committee of 300, as we discussed, all of these shadow entities. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Skull and Bones at Yale University is a big part. It's a training center. By the way, the movie The Skulls is a really good movie. It outlines what goes on at Yale University in Skull and Bones.
It's on
DVD.
The name of the movie is the name of the movie again?
The Skulls.
The Skulls. Appropriately named. Okay.
Yes. Yes. You can get it. I have a copy DVD. Just have to. I think I got mine at Amazon. Not sure, but okay. I have a copy. Nice movie. Gives you the story of what's going on behind the scenes. Very well done. And if some kid tries to get out from underneath it, they're going to kill him. Okay, that's what that movie shows. It shows the power of these people and who they are and how they use the power in government. Oh yes, it's very blatant. It's a very entertaining movie. Anybody who wants to watch it.
Entertaining or informative or both?
Both.
Yeah,
both.
Exactly.
Both. Yeah, it's a good movie. Yeah, yeah. The Bourne Identity movies, they're exciting movies too. They're fiction. But The Skulls is an exciting movie and it is not fiction.
Okay. Well, this might be an appropriate time. You had asked earlier about questions from the audience. And interestingly enough, this came in last Thursday. This is from Kathy from Iowa. And her question is, and this is related to what we're talking about. If you go back to 1871, and I'm citing her email, but these are my own words, interpreting here her question. In 1871, let's see here, where did I write this down? Okay. Or 1870, when you were talking about the 20-year, charters and such, in 1871, there was the Act of 1871 created reportedly a corporation as the United States and a corporate government for the District of Columbia. This, according, cited by Kathy here from Iowa, the Act of 1871 put the United States back under British rule. And we lost our independence. Is there any truth to that outside of the financial side of things?
Is there any proof to that occurring outside of the financial stuff? You've got to remember. Proof. The word proof is a big word. Proof of that outside of the financial. Well, think about this. Again, this is not proof, but this is analysis. Think about this. I mentioned all corporations are owned.
Right.
So who owns USA Corp? And that's proof by itself, just because it's called USA Corp. All corporations are owned. The Federal Reserve is owned.
That's true.
It's a corporation. It's owned.
Yep.
When in 14, it sold stock. Information I have, $200 a share. Who too? The banks who were owned by England, by European banks, Credit Suisse, Barclays, Royal Scottish Bank, Board Bank of England, those banks, okay? Those banks, they have branches in the United States. They own those branches in the United States. Those branches in the United States in 1814 bought the shares of the Federal Reserve.
Okay.
That's how that worked. That gave the Federal Reserve their initial money. So here we go. We have a sequence. Corporations are always owned. That established USA Corp. That established ownership of the United States.
All right. So now the second part to that question, or the final sentence, is a question that she asks. do we have? Are we operating under two different sets or two different constitutions and thus two sets of rules?
We are operating under two sets of rules. Only one constitution has never been replaced. One set of rules are corporate rules, and the other set is the constitution itself.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. We're operating under two set of rules. Corporate rules are important.
And
all corporations have rules.
And Kathy, if you're listening, that was a great question, because I know that there's that's the basis of a lot of confusion out there. Act of 1871, which she references, one constitution, different set of rules, though. Okay.
Yeah, it has to be rules, constitution rules. And think for a moment now. Do you live in an incorporated city? Who owns it?
That's a good point, huh?
Yeah. If you live in an unincorporated area, that means that nobody owns your land. That's a good thing. When you move into an incorporated city, then the city is owned. Your city is owned.
Now, how do we...
By somebody.
How do we find... So let's say...
I've been unable to find the documents that say who owns each one.
Okay. All right. Fair answer.
I've been unable to find those documents.
Interesting.
But corporations are always owned.
Yes, they are.
And they call it USA Corp. It's right there. It's USA Corp.
All right.
In the preface of Volume 2, it spends 9 pages on this very subject of exactly how that came about, what happened, who did it, how it was done, all those kinds of things.
Very interesting. I did touch on that. The interesting part of this, volume two talks about conspiratorial activities, and very interesting. I went over the preface.
Yeah,
I can
word.
Talk.
Yeah.
that's a two syllable word. I'm having trouble, but you're right. Very interesting, how this all plays out. As you mentioned, Woodrow Wilson, 1913 to 1921, Edward Mandel House, as we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you also note here from the private papers of Woodrow Wilson, who said that very soon every American will be required to register their biological property in a national system designed to keep track of the people that will operate under the ancient system of pledging. And, you know, we could spend days talking about just that sentence and those words. So, very interesting.
Yeah.
And you're right. When you were talking about Paul Warburg, the banking establishment led by Paul Warburg, interest having to be paid. Oh my goodness. And the plan to gag the states, and they did that through, as you point out, through amendment
amendments that are unconstitutional because they changed the wording of the Constitution. No, let me say that differently. They're illegal because they changed the wording of the Constitution. They're not unconstitutional because of that. They're illegal because of that.
Right.
That's a difference.
Yes. Yes. And the legal and political side of, you note here, that you cite a book, our so-called government is just another for-profit corporation by Al Whitney, written back in 2013, right? I think that's a book that you cite, but very interesting indeed. So here we are. We find ourselves today in this position. But we don't have two constitutions, folks. We have one. And we're so far away from all of the precepts of this constitution that it's not even funny. So, okay. And that's the basis. We started talking about Article 3 of the Constitution. And you mentioned about treason, felony, corruption of blood, and so on. So how does this connect? If it does, or is this just an add-on to what we were talking about before?
Well, it connects. It connects because of the power behind the scene that's doing it all. You see, none of this stuff happens coincidentally. These guys started way back in Washington's time, Washington knew of and was aware of the Illuminati.
Right.
Okay, he knew of it. He wasn't a part of it, but he knew of it. Now, what do we have? We have people being controlled. How are they controlled? They're controlled with money. Now, let's think this thing through just a little bit. So, see, it's all tied together, every bit of it. Let's just say the Congress passes a law that's absolutely stupid, and we know that it's stupid. It's called the Social Security Law. It's a Ponzi scheme. They throw people in jail that do Ponzi schemes, but they don't throw people in jail in Social Security. It's a Ponzi scheme.
Right.
It was started, passed by law in the 30s. Okay, now, shouldn't have been done. Shouldn't have been done. But they did. So we have a law here that's done. Why did that law get passed? The reason that law got passed was because congressmen did it to keep their seats. Why? How did that happen? Because it takes money to get elected. And the people with the money tell the people that are voting what to vote for. And if you don't vote for that, then you lose your money. Now, there's a really interesting movie called Legally Blonde 2. And that's a very fun movie about for young ladies, and I watch it too. Anyway, there's in Legally Blonde 2, the young lady wants to do something about testing on animals. She has a bill, testing on animals. The person that's her sponsor is agreeing with her to do it. She works in her office. But the power behind the throne comes to the congressman, congresslady, congress, I don't care. It's a generic term. Comes to the congressman and says, Mrs. Whatever, if you sign that bill, we're going to cut off your funds because I got another guy waiting in the wings. So she takes her name off the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And folks, that's how it's done. The freshman senators, freshman representatives show up in Congress. They're all sat down to give orientations. Everybody gets an orientation when they start a new job. Well, they get their orientation. I've never been to one of these, but I can see it in my mind's eye. All the big dudes in the House get together with all the new House people. Well, you guys, we're happy to see you here. It's really nice that you've been elected. And you're going to have a vote and a way to do things for your place, for your organization, for your state, for your community. And we really want you to get involved in it. And we're going to help you. And we only just ask that you help us sometimes when we need it.
Yep.
And if you help us, we'll help you.
Yep.
And the help means money as well as a prestige. You don't help us, you won't be on any good committees, and we'll get rid of you because you won't get reelected because you won't have any money.
That's right.
By the end of the first or second day, these guys are all hoodwinked into how to keep their job.
Yep.
The young lady in the state of Utah, she was elected, started on the 1st of January, and violated all of her commitments by the 5th of January. Oh, that's the same year, by the way.
When you say her commitments, you're talking about her commitments to the people that elected her,
yes.
Put her in that office. That's right. Okay. Yep.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yep.
Yep. She made all these pledges that she was going to do this and that and the other. She was a Republican, and I voted for her. I agreed. She said good things. I liked her. 5 days. Took only 5 days for her to vote against and sponsor things against what she said she was going to do.
Well, obviously, she wants to keep her job. And by the way, I've talked to one person, only one person. I don't want to name this person, who went to Washington as a House member, was elected, and stated exactly. They sat this person down. There was a day of orientation, a day of rules, I guess, if you will. And then the third day of appointments, committee appointments and such. And the first 2 days, if you showed any kind of displeasure about the ruling class in the House, then you were pretty much out of business on day three. And, certainly a one term, office holder. I hope that
that's
makes
it.
Sense.
That's how it works. That's precisely how it works.
Yep.
And money's the telling point. So where does the money come from? Well, let's look at where the money comes from. Banks. I didn't say that, did I? Did I say banks? Yes, I did. Banks. Who owns our banks? Well, the people own the bank are the people who control the bank. In that case, it may not be the actual owners, but it's the controllers. And the controllers are the Federal Reserve, and they control the Federal Reserve back to Europe. Federal Reserve scarfs up all the extra money in the bank. Then they pay them interest, they pay the bank interest, and send money back to them when they need it. But if they don't need it, they keep it. It goes on to their owner banks, which goes back to the European banks, which go back to the Europeans who own those banks. It's banks. How much debt do we have in the United States? Well, I don't know what the number is right this very minute. I could look it up, but it's around $17, $18 trillion we're paying interest on every day. That money is in the billions. The interest payments is in the billions. The interest on the federal debt, which comes out of our hides, is in the billions. All that money goes to the Federal Reserve and finds itself in Europe, and it finds itself in the hands of the what I call the international banking establishment. It's banking, you guys. And then, you see, then the international banking establishment brings it back and buys our politicians so that we get all the right stuff for them.
You know, I'm so glad you're bringing this up, because my question is, if well, it's obviously unconstitutional, what we're under this Federal Reserve system. Think about President Trump, okay? Well, all right, forget about President Trump. Let's say somehow, by an act of God, I was able to become president. I was elected president of the United States, me, Doug Hagman.
Yes.
Okay, so one of the first things I'd do, I mean, if I was true to my my word, is I would say, you know what? The Federal Reserve, this is BS, man. We can't have this. We got to do away with. We have to do away with this. This is unconstitutional. However, I have to get it done. I'm going to get it done. Why?
Jackson did that.
Okay, and how'd he fare?
Yeah, how did he fare? They tried to kill him once or twice. He's out.
Yeah,
but he got rid of the Federal Reserve. Nobody else has ever done that before like he did.
But okay, so my question to you. Is God bless the man? Why hasn't President Donald Trump done that? Tried to do it. Did somebody sit him down and say, "Hey, bud, this is the way it's going to be," you know? Or did they play a video of, you know, JFK getting his head blown off and say, "Yeah, this is your future. Take a look."
I'm a Trump guy. Okay, I'm a Trump fan
all
the way.
Me too.
But I got to say this: he's a businessman.
Yeah,
he gets his loans from the bank.
Yeah, but if we did away with the entire system, we'd have to let's see, how would that work? Maybe.
What we need is our community banks that are not a part of the Federal Reserve.
Right.
So the profit stays in the community, doesn't go to Europe.
But we don't have any of those, do we?
Nope.
Didn't think so.
I'm trying to do them. I'm trying to do some. We do have a few. They're called public citizens banks, but they still wind up in the Federal Reserve system. I'm trying to put together a banks that are not a part of the Federal Reserve system. The profits stay in the community. It'd be community banks.
But so if you did that, we couldn't use Federal Reserve notes, which is some people call.
No. You would still do that. You'd still do all the principles. You'd still do that, and you still have to be a part of the FDIC, because the states pass laws that you have to be. You still have to use the money trading, the clearinghouses, because you got to have your checks cleared. And you still use your credit cards. You'll still use those things. But when it rolls around and comes around, the profits stay in the community.
Right.
And those profits go to the community to build nicer things for the community.
Well, pretty soon, if you would do that, pretty soon these communities would see the benefit. I mean, who would at that point stick with a Federal Reserve Bank, given the benefits of a community bank like you just described? They wouldn't. So then that could internally, or that could cause the collapse of the Federal Reserve System.
Absolutely, without a gun being fired or without a vote in Congress.
But boy, I'll tell you what, I'd hire a food taster if I were you.
Yeah. I've got a target on my back. I really do.
Yeah.
I really, sometimes I get cut off on the David Knight show. Sometimes I get cut off, so I can't talk to him anymore.
Well, that's not going to happen here, doggone it. Because Eric the Tech put in redundant systems and we got, well, anyway. But so yeah. No, that's a very interesting.
I think it's my phone.
Well,
I think it's my phone. I don't think it's David. It's my phone.
You know, boy. Yeah, I can imagine talk like this could get you, you know, cut off.
Yeah, they're not happy with it. But I am at this moment working through the laws of the state of Utah, making sure that I pass, that I do all the laws,
okay,
and all the procedures and all the banking procedures, and I'm getting ready to set up a community bank.
All right, so let's talk about that for a second, because people are demand. I mean, I cannot tell you how many emails I get, how many people who send me communications, letters. They say, we got to do something. You know, we talking about it is just, you can talk about it all day long. But so how can people help you? Because if we can accomplish this, a lot of our ills will be fixed. Well, maybe, you know. So
well,
how can we
anybody,
help you?
Anybody who wants to, I will share the information I have of how to do this and what it means and how it's done. Mind you, I haven't done it yet. So don't sit back and say, well, you know, he'll know how to do it. No, I'm still working through getting it done. I've been to the treasurer. I've been to the financial guys in the state to make sure that I know exactly what I have to do. And they gave me stuff that I had to do. And I've read the books. I'm reading the stuff they gave me, making sure I'm doing it all. I'm going to visit a bank examiner. He'd have him teach me tomorrow, in fact. Have him go over all the stuff that I've done, make sure that I'm not missing something. But here's a very important piece of it. Now, just everybody listening that wants to, put your mind around this thought. Doug, I talked about this last time. You're going to go buy a car.
Uh-huh.
Didn't I mention that last time? $100,000 car. And you're going to go to the bank.
In my dreams, by the way. But go ahead. Yes.
Okay, well, that's okay. It's a good dream. It's a
yes.
good dream. And you're going to sign the paperwork at the bank for $100,000 with payments of $10,000 a month. You're going to pay it off in a year, that kind of thing.
All right.
You're rolling in dough, see?
Anyway, sure I am.
You're going to do that.
Hear that, Matt?
So here we go.
Sorry.
They send a check to the dealership. The dealership has a check. They don't send money. They send a check. It'd be a certified check, too. It doesn't make any difference. It's a check, not money. Now, the dealership does all their stuff with that money because it is money to them. It's wealth to them. Now, you come back the next month with your $10,000 check, and you give that to the bank to make your first payment.
I'm there. Yep. I'm standing at the teller window. Yep. There it is.
Here's my question. What does the bank do with that money?
Well, I don't know.
And that's where it gets binding. They paid for the car with a check. They don't owe anything on the car. It's done.
Wait. Okay, hold on. Okay, so let me recap this. Folks, have patience with me, okay? I'm not the brightest bulb So, wait. So I go to the bank. I get a $100,000 loan to buy a car. The bank sends that money. So they got money.
Check. They don't send any money. Check. Nope.
Okay, so they send a check. Well, wait a second. If they send a check, don't they have to have stuff, you know, to cover that? Because I have,
well,
if I write a check, I got to have money in my account. Or.
Oh, yeah, you do. Yeah, you do. Well, let's think about it for a minute. Go back to how everybody knows about the bank can loan out $9 for every $10 that's put in their bank.
Yep.
Okay, so let's put $10,000 in bank one, and the bank can then that month loan out $9,000. Now, that $9,000 is against the 10. That's very clear. The next month, they can loan out $8,100. Where does that money come from? And the next month, they can loan out $7,200. Where does that money come from? And when they finish, on that $10,000, they loaned out the first nine against the money that was deposited, but the other 81, they just wrote checks. The money's created when you sign the documents.
Don't you wish you can do that, folks? Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So now I understand. All right. Which, okay, I understand the concept of that. I think most people do.
What does the bank do with the money that you pay them, the 10 grand?
That's an interesting, I don't think I've ever asked that question.
Nobody else does either. They just think it's going to pay the loan, but the loan's already satisfied. There is no loan. They send a check. It's done.
Maybe
they don't want to say this next sentence. They don't want to say. I asked this question in when I was talking to the treasurer. They're banking people. They know about banks.
Right.
I asked this question. What does the bank do with the money? He says, well, it pays for board and room, and it pays for the help, and it pays for the building and utilities, all that kind of stuff. Oh, yes, it does. That's right. That's right. What does it do with the rest?
Yeah.
loan it out. And that's exactly how it came. They loan it out.
All right. So they loan it out. But that starts the whole process over again, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, doesn't it? They loan it out. Now they have to have that money come in, and they have an account that shows that it's there. Then they can loan out that $9,000. And what's happening now? Now let's put it in a house loan rather than a car loan. And let's have this be a 30-year loan, and you have to pay $2,000 a month to the bank every month for the next 30 years.
Okay.
Remember, it all works the same. They didn't pay for the house. The money's all created when you sign the paperwork. So that means that every month you're going to send them $2,000 every month for 30 years. And they're going to loan that money out again to another person who's going to buy a house, and they're going to send them $2,000 every month for 30 years. In 12 months, they got a lot of money coming in on just that one set of loans, don't they?
Yes.
If you put that down on a pencil, you see there's more profit coming in on a bank than anything else that's ever done. If the bank ever says to you, don't invest in that, it's low, it's high risk, high interest, everything they do is high interest. Everything they do is theft of our money. But if that profit stayed in the community, it wouldn't be theft of our money because we would get benefits from it.
I can see that. I can also see about 1,000 emails from bankers coming in. But yeah, I can see that. Okay. All right. Wow.
Well. Just a thought. These are just thoughts. But those are thoughts. That's what's going on.
Well, we need to have these conversations because how else are we going to unscrew what has been so screwed up if we don't start talking about this? And I can't believe such a simple question. What do they do with that money? And folks, I get the answer. Well, you know, but wow, this opens up an entirely different, discussion, I suppose.
Yes, the profit and the interest too, not just the interest. They keep the profit and the interest because they don't have to pay, the principal. They keep the principal and the interest. They don't have to pay the principal to anybody. There's no debt.
Right.
They paid for the car already.
How much of that cut does the Fed get, the Federal Reserve get?
Now, this is an area I don't know the exact numbers of, but this is what I understand occurs. I have to say it that way because I'm not talked to a banker who tells me that exactly. None of the tellers or the bank branch managers don't know anything about this. It's not done at their level.
Right.
But this is what I think happens, and I'm pretty sure this is exactly right. On a daily basis, the money that's coming into a bank, extra money that's coming into a bank over above expenses, that kind of stuff, is wired to the Federal Reserve. And as they need it, it's wired back from the Federal Reserve to the bank. And the Federal Reserve pays them interest on the money when it's there. But it's wired to the Federal Reserve.
Okay.
At some point, that becomes profit. Now they don't pay interest on it anymore. And now it's profit now. And I don't know the details of that. There's some of the details that I don't understand quite. So that's why I'm still learning about doing this. I haven't done it yet, but I'm in the process right now of putting the last things on procedures and how does it happen and what goes on. I don't know the answers to that. But I do know that money flows to the Federal Reserve regularly, and it flows back from the Federal Reserve to the banks regularly. And banks run out of money they can loan. Why? Because it's in the Federal Reserve.
Right.
But what if it were in your own bank, and it didn't go to the Federal Reserve?
Oh, happy day, in a sense. Yeah, okay.
That profit stays in the community.
Right.
And you can do lots of stuff in the community.
And who among us wouldn't want that? Okay. And by the way, folks, Dr. Richard Proctor is my guest. Saving the Constitution is his book, one of many, actually. The series Liberty, Will It Survive? Highly recommended because that gets into some deep stuff. Oh, is it good? I've got the series. Neener. And book on
one
economics.
Thing, Doug.
Go ahead.
I'd like to mention about the books. Folks are going to notice there's a lot of articles in the books. And some of the articles are dated 2008, 7, 12, 15, yep. All kinds of things. They'll also find that the full article is listed.
Giving
credit to everybody, the people who wrote it, they get credit for it, where it is, who published it, yep. That's all there. But I list the article. The reason I did that is because if you get an article out of the New American, for example, and you say, well, I'd like to get that article again, maybe they can find it, and maybe they can't. If you go to all the journals and all the newspapers, it's in the archives, maybe they can find it, and maybe they can't.
That's right.
It's a horrible problem to try to get the article. And I want to have the information in that article in the book so we can talk about it. So it's in the article. It's in the book.
Yeah. And it makes my reading a heck of a lot easier. So I don't have to go hunting for things. And, you know, it's.
Yeah. I don't have to do IBID. It's there.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't have to say, look it up on this page. It's there. I don't do that with books, of course. But all the articles.
Yeah.
That's what I do with the article. I do it so people can have it in front of them and not have to depend on what I say. They can read the article for themselves.
Man, I'll tell you what. You've done a great job on this. And then thank you for writing it. You know, I can't believe we're about 2 minutes away from the end of the program. I don't know where this time has gone. Eric the Tech, did you advance that program clock? I want to know. No? Okay.
Yeah,
I'm telling you, this is fascinating stuff. So, but all of this, you know, just this one vein of discussion shows us how far away from things we've gotten. Oh my goodness.
Yes. And we got to get back. Somehow we've got to get back. And we get back by getting our states right. And our states nullify things that are wrong. That's how we get back.
That is correct. You're just a fat. I mean, I'll tell you, I could speak. We could have marathons of discussion. I want to thank you, Dr. Proctor, for your gracious gift of time. You're going to come back next week as well?
Yeah. Oh, yes. I'd like to come. Okay. Let me just say it this way. I'd like to come back every week.
Please. Because
it's
think,
up to you, Doug. It's your show.
Well, you know, folks, this is something, and I'm telling you right now, this is something that we have to drill down because I'm going to say this one last time. There is so much disinformation out there. It's unbelievable. Don't listen to people who think they know what they're talking about, but are Muppets and mopes and, you know, Dr. Proctor has the experience, the education, and of course, the work product to prove he knows what he's talking about. So I want to thank you. The book, Saving the Constitution, that's the prime book, Constitution, if you can keep it, as well as Bathroom Economics and all the rest at provisinstitute.com. We're out of time. So next week, same place, same time, right?
And we'll chat about more things, yes. Maybe we'll chat about the Second Amendment. Maybe we'll chat about, the article or the fifth article. I don't know. We'll talk about something.
We'll talk about something. And as a matter of fact, folks, studio@HagmanReport.com. Studio@HagmanReport.com for your questions. Thank you, Kathy from Iowa, for that question. And that was one of, actually, I missed probably four or five. But I'm going to say thank you, Dr. Proctor, and let's keep in touch in the meantime off air. And you're not suicidal, right? You're not suicidal. We're not going to find you with a... I'm kidding. That's
yeah. Right.
You know.
No, I'm not suicidal. If somebody claims it was. It wasn't.
Amen to that. All right, my brother. Thank you so very much. God bless you, and thank you for your gracious gift of time. We'll talk to you next week.
You bet. Thank you.
Folks, that'll do it for me tonight. I want to say again thank you to everyone, including Rhonda, Eric the Tech, Kevin, Matt. God bless all of you. And, of course, Dr. Richard Proctor. And, folks, thank you as well. HagmanStore.com, HagmanReportLive.com, HagmanReport.com. Until tomorrow, God bless.